We are absolutely delighted that SearchPress is again sponsoring the podcast. They are the leading supplier of arts and crafts books here in the UK, and SearchPress publish beautiful, very practical books that delight, inspire, and instruct artists and crafters of all skill levels the world over. You may remember the episode we recorded with Chief Editor Ed Ralph from Season 5. Extremely interesting. Definitely check it out. To see all of the wonderful books that they have on offer, please visit searchpress.com.
Hi, I'm Peter Keegan.
And I'm Tom Shepherd.
And welcome to Ask an Artist, the podcast designed for working artists and makers who are looking for tips and advice, ideas and strategies for not only making, but selling and promoting their work too.
Joining us in this episode is David Poxon. He's a lifelong painter and internationally renowned award-winning watercolourist, artist, tutor and author, as well as the founder of the world famous International Watercolour Masters event here in the UK, and of course, so much more. And in this first chat, we are going to dive deep into David's journey as an artist, his career to date, as well as the driving forces and the approaches to his painting, along with his fascination of watercolour techniques. Welcome, David. We're very excited to have you here.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Peter and Tom. But for me, it's a great delight, and let's hope what I say has some meaning.
I'm sure it will. We're very excited to get stuck in. We will be talking in a different episode about the International Watercolour Masters, but today we want to talk about you and your art and your kind of journey and your career. I'm always keen to kick off just hearing a little bit more about your personal journey. You know, when did you first pick up a paintbrush? Were you painting as a child? And how did that kind of move into your career as an artist?
Okay, well, let's start at the beginning, which for me was when I was around 4 years old. So I was born in Wolverhampton, which is in the West Midlands, also known as the Black Country, with one of the greatest football teams in the world. And as a little boy, I was surrounded by industry, steelworks, coal, lots of fog, lots of smog. Not very much colour. Everything was covered in dust. Everyone seemed to wear long grey macs and flat caps, a little bit like a Lowry painting, except that it was Wolverhampton. So that was my childhood. I don't think I actually saw any trees until I was about 10. And my playground were backyards, rubbish heaps, loads of boxes. And although it was a fairly deprived area I was living in, I had a very happy childhood, which was stimulated by my family and all the people that I used to play football with. When I was 4, my grandmother gave me a De La Rowney tin of watercolours as a Christmas present. Now, there were no artists in my family. They were all very hardworking people. Nobody knew quite what to do with this tin of watercolours, and I've still got that tin even now. I don't use it now, but occasionally I look at it just to touch base and know that that's where I actually came from. So I got this tin of watercolour paints, opened it up, and there was a world of colour, like a jewel box. So suddenly I'd gone from this grey environment in which I lived, very muted colours, to a world of colour in this tin. And I think at that moment, a flame was lit, like the Olympic flame. And I just became absolutely obsessed with this tin of watercolour paints. We knew that I had to put this paint onto something. So there were rolls of old wallpaper which were stashed in a cupboard, and my mother and grandmother cut the wallpaper up into little 12-inch squares and gave me a great big pile of this paper. And it's on that wallpaper. There were patterns on the wallpaper as well, which didn't make it very easy. On this paper, I would be experimenting, practicing, and trying to make sense of this tin of watercolour paints. And when I look at this watercolour tin now, I can see which were the colours that totally possessed me at the time. Colours like burnt sienna, yellow ochre, cobalt blue, cerulean blue. And they're the ones that are the most used. So off I went on this watercolour journey. My father was a vegetable merchant, and he had a truck, and he used to travel around farms collecting loads of potatoes and cabbages and everything. Occasionally, as a treat, he would take me in his truck to visit farms. From memory, it always seemed to be raining or cold, probably because that's when they were trying to get the crops in the autumn. So he'd take me. Now, that's where I came across tractors for the first time. Sometimes I got roped into helping pick potatoes, which is a 4 and 5 year old is not a very nice task. But the highlight of these visits was having a ride on the tractor. Even as I'm talking about it now, I am right back there on my first tractor journey. Incredible. Just the thrill of it. Tractors themselves, they were characters. They weren't inanimate objects. They were alive, and the tractors, to me, seemed to look like the farmers, and the farmers looked like the tractors. I was fascinated with these machines. They were my first two big moments in my life, really, as far as I can remember. Getting that tin of watercolour paints and coming into contact with tractors for the first time. Consequently, I couldn't wait to get home and start to try and paint tractors. And tractors were the first subjects I tried to paint. Hours and hours, hundreds and hundreds of these pieces of wallpaper. All the tractors seemed to be either blue or red. And, of course, they weren't shiny tractors. They were workhorses with a beautiful patina on the surface, bits of metal falling apart. And I was trying, even at that age, to replicate that texture.
I relate so much to that box of colours. I remember visiting, I'm from South Wales, and visiting my grandmother in the valleys, and she had this little tin box of coloured pencils, and they had these exotic names like ultramarine blue and raw sienna, and I just thought it was blue and brown, but there was this mystical depth to them, and I instantly wanted to start using them. And like you, my original drawings were using these colours I had a very rich fascination with.
I'm curious then, as you were growing up by your family, were you supported and kind of nourished to be creative? And how did that lead you through school and take you into sort of the leap to become a professional artist as well? When was that for you?
So I'd rush home from school, and usually I would either be trying to be Robin Hood or Davy Crockett or something like this, or a spaceman. But my first reach was always to my tin of watercolour paints. It became my constant companion. My parents, pretty, my mother and my grandmother, could see the effect that this tin of Dale Rowney paints had on me. They decided to take me on a day trip to London. They took me to the Tate Gallery. And I don't think they'd ever been to the Tate Gallery. So for all of us, it was a big adventure. And no one quite knew how to behave. Unfortunately, these galleries only really hang their paintings for adults. So as a little book that was peering up at this masterpiece, Hannibal Crossing the Alps. I had no idea who Hannibal was or what the Alps were. But it just sounded amazing. Hannibal Crossing the Alps. My grandmother said, this is a painting, it's called Hannibal Crossing the Alps. Wow. It was like the title of a film. Looking at that, and I can see it now, lots of muted greys and fawns and ochres, and one of the attendants sitting there could see I'm peering up at this painting for about 10 minutes, it seemed like forever, came up and said, you like that painting, don't you, little chap, or whatever he said to me. Yes. He said, can you see an elephant in the painting? And, you know, that just drove me nuts because I couldn't quite see an elephant. And yet he said there was an elephant there. So there must have been an elephant there, and there probably is. I think there is, actually. And there I am looking at this huge, and that had such an effect. And of course, then there's the other Turner paintings. Bridge at Norham Castle, where Turner's wonderful kaleidoscope of colours are being dissolved by the atmosphere and the light and everything. And you can't quite make things out. Wind, rain and steam, another one. I can see them now. Fantastic paintings, which I had no idea how they were made. I didn't know anything about oil paints or anything. To me, he must have painted them with watercolour paints. They bought me a little pamphlet. Off we went back home. Then I set about trying to be J.M.W. Turner.
I think we've all been there.
Yes. My tractors were suddenly dissolving into the light and everything else, you know. So instead of just trying to replicate things exactly in every little nut and bolt, I went off into more of an abstract world, really, but still trying to make things look like they were. So what I think I was trying to capture was the essence and the feeling of things, so you knew what you were looking at, even though you couldn't quite see it.
It's so interesting because I would pinpoint one of my major artistic revelations, if you want to call it that, at a fairly young age, not quite as young as you were, was also related to Turner. I remember seeing my first large Turner and being almost completely absorbed into the painting. I remember it well. And I feel like, I don't quite know the word to use here, but I feel like your interpretation of it looking back is quite a mature one, this kind of understanding of wanting to represent the subject, but not necessarily completely literally, like capturing the essence and the character of it. There's a certain level of the subject dissolving so that you don't see every part of it. So I'm curious about your subject matter in general, because obviously you've started with kind of tractors and you've spoken about your kind of attraction to patina and texture and the character. And obviously these days your subject matter is much more broad, but it's certainly united by kind of common themes. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit now in the present and sort of how you've got to this point, what has attracted you to your subject. It's almost like we can understand where the little seed was planted, but more as like a more developed artist, what are you attracted to as a subject and what are you looking for to turn that into a painting?
In my teenage years, I discovered oil painting, trying to replicate Turner's depiction of light, because light, even that in what I do now, light is the greatest component in terms of light dissolves everything and commands everything. When I was became a student, 18, 19 years old, and I went to Brighton Art College to start off with. In my mind, I wanted to learn how to paint things that looked like things. However, at that time, trying to paint things that looked realistic was a no-go zone. It was abstract expressionism. One of the first assignments was we were given an onion, okay, and the assignment was paint this onion in whatever you want to paint it in. The lecturer said, this is terrible. This is one of the worst paintings I've ever seen. It looks like an onion. And I said, it's because it is an onion. He said, we don't want it to look like an onion. And that ended up being a little bit of an issue, shall we say, where I completely disagreed with what this teacher was telling me. And I don't want to be in here, and left. And so I wasn't there very long. Fortunately, I was able to enroll on another course somewhere else doing history. So that did knock my confidence in trying to paint. And it was very discouraging. And at that time, I actually went off it. But I actually stopped doing art for a while. That really affected me. Had to make a living. And I was actually in the music industry for quite a few years. Not as a musician. My trying to be a rock star days came and went. And I found that I was more, my ability lay in organizing other people. So that's what I used to do, organise production tours all around the world. During the course of that, I can't remember exactly when, I rediscovered my love of art. I found it very therapeutic, and that's where the therapy comes in of art. And after quite a few years of that, I was able to exit that world, and I thought, right, now I'm going to concentrate on my first love, which was painting and is painting. And I did have another job at the time as well, so I still had to earn some money, of course. And Saturday mornings was my going out clean air painting day. By this time, I was living back up in the Midlands in Shropshire, where I live now. So I'd go to Lichfield Cathedral. One Saturday morning, the weather was absolutely atrocious, and I was living in a terraced house. There was a wall between my house and the next house, and the next door neighbour was an elderly lady called Miss Potter. And she shouted over the wall because she knew I painted. I'd got, by this time, a shed down the bottom of my garden, which was my studio, a little wooden shed, which I'd go and paint in. She said, "Are you going out painting today?" I said, "It's raining, I can't go today." She said, "I've got something for you to paint." And over the top of this wall, she threw an old enamel bucket, one of those pale cream white ones. And it just missed me and landed. She said, "Go and paint that." So, I mean, I was a lot alarmed and slightly scared by this prospect, but I picked it up, because I'm quite often do as I'm told, and took it to my studio down the bottom of the garden and set it up. And it's while I was trying to draw that bucket, I realized how little I knew about drawing. I didn't know anything about drawing. Even though I'd been drawing Lichfield Cathedral and all these other fancy things for years and years and years, I actually knew nothing. Because with something like a bucket, there is no hiding place. It is what it is. There's a form, there are curves to it, there's an ellipse. Now, this particular bucket was falling to bits. It was all rusty, there were holes in it and everything else, but to me, it was more interesting because it was like that. And I was weeks and weeks and weeks trying to draw and paint this bucket. Eventually, persevered, because I'm that kind of quite persistent person, and then it came to the problem of painting it. Well, with the type of watercolour painting I do, which is pure watercolour painting, I don't use any white paint, no white paint whatsoever. Any white in my painting is the white of the paper, and I don't use black either. So I had to paint this white enamel bucket without using any white paint. First problems. I never encountered that kind of problem. This whole journey was a new journey for me, learning how to paint in watercolour, pure watercolour, this form, this bucket. And I persevered, kept going. Eventually, it looked okay. It looked like it was supposed to look. And during that, I became fascinated in how to replicate rust. Whether it's wet rust, dry rust, different elements, oxidization, it's not just brown or burnt sienna. There are lots of other colors in it. Mm-hmm. In fact, rust is a whole other world of its own, in itself. A whole world. You can spend a lifetime trying to investigate rust. Anyway, so I did all that. Miss Potter said to me, "How are you getting on with your bucket?" So I showed her the book. She said, "Well, not bad." She said, "When I die, you can have everything that's in my garden shed," she said. Pretty soon after that, she did pass away, unfortunately. And one of her relatives said, "She's left you the contents of her garden shed in her will." "Oh, thank you very much. So would you like to go and take what's in there?" So I had to prise the door open. It was more or less sealed solid. In that shed was, to me, an absolute treasure trove, because I'd done the rusty old enamel bucket. in this shed, there were boxes of corned beef from the Second World War, tins of corned beef, loads of things falling to bits, of course, and in there was an old Qualcast push lawnmower. It had been pushed up and down somebody's lawn hundreds of miles, hundreds of times, done its work, and it was in retirement in this shed with an old wooden handle. I pulled it out, took it to my studio and the other stuff that I could use as painting subjects, set it up and painted this old Qualcast lawnmower. And I can see that now, little bits of peeling green paint, little bits of peeling red paint intermingled with this rust, the problems of the form again, same with the bucket, but by then I was getting the hang of it. The wooden handle, which was splintered and split, with the grain showing through, wonderful siennas, yellow ochres, bits of burnt sienna in there. Just a whole other world to discover. And I painted that Qualcast lawnmower several times. Finally, I thought, well, I'm actually quite pleased with that. As painters will know, the part that you enjoy the most is usually when you're painting. When you've finished a painting, quite often you feel dissatisfied with what you've done. Now, wherever you are in your artistic journey, and we're all on the same road, this feeling is not just your feeling. We all feel that way. So don't be alarmed. Don't be afraid. Carry on, because your best painting is always your next one. Anyway, I painted the Qualcast lawnmower in pure watercolour. And I thought, well, I wonder how it would look framed. And I'd never had a painting framed before. So I took it to a local framing shop. Quite nervous I was actually about taking this painting, because you never quite know if somebody's going to laugh at what you've done. And anyway, they framed it. It looked pretty good. And at that point, I thought, well, it is actually pretty good. When your paintings get framed properly, correctly, with glass in front of them, which watercolour paintings should always have glass in front of them, it's like they're getting dressed up to go out for the night. And suddenly, they're not naked anymore. They're not the naked being that you were sharing your time with when you were painting them. They are dressed up, ready to go out into the world. And I got my courage up and entered it into a contest that was taking place at the Royal Birmingham Society of Artists, which was in Birmingham, it still is, RBSA, entered it into that, it got accepted. And it really does give you a boost when your work gets accepted into an exhibition or a contest. So this painting of the Qualcast lawnmower in the RBSA exhibition got first prize, £500, a lot of money. And I went to the opening of the exhibition. So we're standing there with a lukewarm glass of white wine, which is typical. And all the other paintings in the show were your typical paintings of the sea, a river, a landscape, somebody's dog. There was nothing else that looked like a Qualcast lawnmower that was falling to bits in the show. And I think some of the people there were quite startled that my painting had won this prize. However, I got £500, and somebody bought that painting as well, so that was an extra bit of money, and that was it. I was set on my way. I'd found my true calling, which was to replicate things, objects, scenarios that had worked for a living on paper in pure watercolour, and the more texture for me, the better, so that I could get my painting fix.
I love hearing that kind of evolution of your artist creations and your journey and these little kind of affirmations along the way. And I love your thing that I notice with your work, and you've kind of alluded to it here, is you're quite often choosing subjects that many of us would completely overlook. And now hearing your journey, I completely understand where that's come from. I'm kind of curious as to, with all the different mediums out there, why it's kind of watercolour that you've stuck with in pursuit of these specific subjects, because there's so many other ways that you could approach this.
The absolute unpredictability of watercolour painting, watercolour itself as a medium, fascinated me and became another obsession, that I needed to find ways to control the paint, although you never can quite control it, learn techniques, develop my own techniques, how I can get myself out of trouble when it goes a little bit wrong, and pull it back to where I want the painting to be. Bear in mind also that art materials are not cheap. So while I was painting, and I'd got lots of reject pieces of paper, and pieces of watercolour paper are quite expensive. So rather than waste them, I'd paint on top of something I'd already painted. Now, because it was watercolour paint and the paints are transparent, during that episode, I discovered that I could do layering, glazing, multi-layering. And multi-layering has become a part of my repertoire that I think I'm quite well known for. All the time, trying to preserve the light from the paper, the white paper, you cannot get whiter than white paper, to try to preserve the glow coming through the paint. Each layer you put on transforms the way it looks. So when people look at some of my work and they say, what colour is that blue? It's impossible to say. Take your time, because watercolour painting is not a race. It's a search for yourself. If it was an animal, it would be a cat. So if you've got a cat and you stroke the cat's fur the right way, it will purr and it will be friendly, very friendly, as long as you're friendly. If you try to stroke the fur the wrong way, you will enter a world of pain. And it's the same with watercolour painting.
Being a predominantly watercolourist myself and teaching a lot of people, I know how easy it can be for a watercolour painting to sort of go wrong or to run away from you. You get that horrible overwork look, or you lose that kind of glow that you're talking about. And I think a lot of people, myself included, might wrongly think that by using so many layers, you're in danger of overworking or killing the freshness of the page. But as you've just said, if you understand the medium and you're working with the flow of the fur, as it were, actually there's a lot of flexibility and a lot of freedom in the medium beyond what we might initially think.
It's exactly right, Tom. And it's really, artists out there who want to learn watercolour painting, it's worthwhile taking a little bit of time to read the tubes. Read what it says on the tubes, all those instructions that you get with the colour charts, because on there's a wealth of technical information. Watercolour paint itself, they're all different to each other. They are all like little people, actually. They've all got their own little characters. Some of them are very friendly, and some of them are horrible, and they won't be nice to you. And they're best avoided, just like some people. Some paints are very insipid, they're very dense, others are very dense, and they will wreck. It's like inviting the wrong person to your party. They'll like take over and wreck everything and start to drink everything that's there or something, and you wish you hadn't invited them. I've got some colours that I've actually put them in a different box. I never go near them. To me, they're peak there. Creatures best avoided. Over the years, develop the colours I reach for. And I know my colours that I choose. It's like a very friendly family. I know that they work together. So any kind of combination of them, and they will complement each other and work with each other as a mix together, or in the layering technique, they will slowly modulate the colours beneath to create a beautiful thing. If everything's going right, they don't always go right. When they do, it's fantastic. If they don't, take it off the board, put it away, get another piece of paper out.
And so, David, I love the way you've explained, you know, the materials there. And I think for me, the takeaway point is, yes, a kind of a sensitivity to watercolour and how it behaves, what you can and can't do, and also then a technical understanding to a point of the properties of the medium itself. But I think one thing that I want to pull out of that is also, you've spoken a lot about when things go wrong. So it's obviously an important factor here in the evolution of your own work and the development of any listener, is that there will be perceived failures and mistakes and times when it doesn't go right. And you've already mentioned this, that you're quite sort of determined and persistent. That's obviously been a key part of your artistic development. And I think it's an important thing for listeners to hear, is persistence with your vision and persistence with your artistic kind of practice.
Persistence is very important. In order to be successful with your persistence, you need to plan. Art and planning quite often are not things that go together. They're because people are so excited, they just want to paint something on a piece of paper without really thinking about it. They want to get going. They're excited. They want to, and then they want something that looks great, and they want people to come up and say, "That's fantastic." Forget all that. Put it away. That's not what it's about. The most important time is your painting time. What happens after it is irrelevant. It may be great, it may be not so good. It doesn't matter. But to get to your painting time, with watercolour especially, you need to spend a few moments, minutes, hours, thinking about what it is you're trying to do. Now, that may sound boring, but believe me, just like stroking that cat the wrong way, thinking time is never wasted time, and you can save yourself a world of pain. First of all, you need to decide what it is you want to paint. In order to do that, you need to be moved by the subject that you want to paint. Whether it's a landscape, seascape, a river, whatever it is, or your favourite person, or a footballer, or, in my case, the types of subjects I paint. I need to be emotionally moved by that subject. It needs to touch the nerve ends. Because, particularly in my work doesn't take an hour or two to do. It can take days or weeks. And I need to be able to sustain my enthusiasm all through the painting process, even though a lot of the time what I'm trying to end up with doesn't look like what it is I'm painting on the board due to all these different layers. And at times I feel I'm like an archaeologist when I'm working on my paintings, because my original drawing lines, scaffold lines I call them, which are just a few basic lines, so point me in the right direction where things are supposed to be, can get lost beneath all these layers of paint. So I have to find them again. And that's where the archaeology comes in, burrowing through the layers of paint to find that line, and is it in the right place? Preparation for painting and planning is very important. Having that moment of inspiration and enthusiasm, try to hang on to that and prepare yourself. I don't have one board prepared. I have about 10 boards of half imperial. I have about 10 boards of quarter imperial, and I have some full sheet boards, three or four of those, and they're always ready, stretched. So if I'm having a day where I don't particularly want to paint, or something's gone wrong, or something, because we all have good days and bad days, I'll always do something to do with the preparation and the planning. I will prepare some more boards.
We'll take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to find out, I suppose, a little bit more from our guest, David Poxon, on how he runs his successful art career as a successful art business. I thought it a good idea to talk about one of my very favourite Rosemary & Co. brush types, and one, and I think I'm right in saying this, that I use in every single painting I create, and that's the Ultimate brush. Designed as the perfect oil painting brush, the Ultimate brush is made with the best quality Chinese hog interlocking bristles, meaning it's less likely to splay, yet it still offers the perfect balance and is one of the most hard-wearing brushes available. Now, traditionally, bristle was used by artists who required a strong, loaded stroke, and the bristles of these brushes are strong and rough in texture, ideal for those artists who revel in thick, textured mark making or love to handle paint thickly. Now, in my own painting, I use them mostly for the block-in stages of an oil painting, as they offer excellent coverage and still provide the texture of each of my marks, something that I love to have in my own work. So a brush all oil painters should have in their brush pot, and one that I certainly couldn't do without. Now, if you'd like to find out more information about these brushes, or would like to order your own free mail order catalogue shipped anywhere around the world, then simply visit rosemaryandco.com. And next time you make your order, make sure you let them know that you were sent there by Ask an Artist podcast. Welcome back to Ask an Artist with me, Peter Keegan.
And me, Tom Shepherd, where we are talking to David Poxon, successful watercolourist, and indeed a teacher of art, which is what we want to touch on briefly in part two. So how much of a role has teaching played in your career? And I'm always interested, kind of a second part to this, like, how do you feel like it's influenced your personal development as an artist as well?
Strange I should hear you say that, Tom, because, you know, you're the first person that's called me a teacher. And I don't think I've ever thought of myself as a teacher. With art, you get a lot of people that set themselves up as teachers of art, but really, they're still trying to find out about it themselves. Having said that, of course, you never stop finding out about art. It is an endless quest. We never stop learning about art. And until the day we leave the earth, and I mean, if I'm lucky enough to go to heaven, then I hope there's painting in heaven, and so I can carry on my art journey. So the way I look at it is, we're all on the same road as artists, whether we're just beginners or just thinking about it, or a little bit further down the road or very established, we're all on that same road. And a lot of people are trying to travel along that road too fast. Just like a real highway, it should have speed limits. And it's important to take a break and stop and admire the view rather than trying to rush to the end of the journey. Because it's not the end of the journey that's important. It's the journey itself. So, sharing what I know. And I don't claim to know everything. I've been quite fortunate in my own journey, having developed my particular way of painting. I was fortunate in that I've been invited to not just shows in the UK, but shows all over the world. And in the course of those trips to exhibit, I've met lots of other great painters, some of whom have become friends and some have become influences. And I've realized that there are so many different ways you can take watercolor painting, whether it in not just subject areas, but techniques, trying to master the medium, that it is not just an endless journey, it is an endless quest to find your own self. And really, all of us, whether you're a beginner or somebody at the other end of the road, we're all trying to find ourselves and trying to find our own way of doing things, our unique take on it. Now, when you're learning, like workshops, when I do workshops, of course, usually the people in the workshop, and I can be doing a workshop in France, in America, China, anywhere, they're familiar with what I do, and they want to learn how to do what I do. In my workshops, I keep no secrets. what you see is what you get. And I stick with them. It's not about me doing the workshop. It's not an ego trip for me to do a workshop and to show them how clever I am. What I'm there to do is to help them along that journey, make sure they're comfortable, they're receptive, they're in the right mental zone to be able to absorb what I'm saying to them. And I always start off with a very meaningful, I start my workshops with a very meaningful, honest and open transmission of the emotions required to get the most out of this wonderful journey, which is making art. And it's usually a quiet, meditative period before we begin. And I can reach out, try and touch the nerve ends of the people in the room and stimulate them into wanting to know and wanting to do and falling in love with it, if not for the first time, but forever.
I think reinforce as well that it's a lifelong pursuit, you know, it's lifelong learning. And as you quite rightly said, it's there's always new ways, there's new techniques, there's a new sense of discovery. And then that propels you to get up the next day and continue painting and continue discovering. And you know, that's wonderfully infectious. And that's what we try. I certainly try and do in my classes as well. You know, I'm learning as much from their discovery and my learning of the technique. And that's wonderfully fulfilling and wonderfully propelling as we move forward. David, what I'd like to find out a little about you, I mean, you've worked with so many fantastic artists around the world, which has led you to kind of develop your career, not just creatively, but also kind of professionally in running yourself as an artist, as an artistic business. So you've seen many artists sort of operate their businesses in different ways. Now, we all know some artists are very blessed with the business skills and those, you know, certainly struggle with that business and managing side. And I'm not saying, as we know, there's no right or wrong way of running your art career as a business. But from your perspective, how do you balance that level of being an artist, a creative person, but also running it as a successful business? And what sort of key tactics and principles do you stick by that helps you keep running it in that way?
I would say the foremost element that you need, everybody needs, and not everybody can get this, you need to be 100% reliable. That is it. If you're reliable and what you say is not only believable, but what you say will happen, that you will turn up at that time, that you will deliver that work at that time, there are no excuses for it not to happen. You will get to be totally professional. It's only by being professional in that sense that you can stand any chance at all of succeeding in art or in any work that you do in life, in anything you do. You know, if you're supposed to be playing for a football team at 3 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon, there's no point turning up at 4 p.m. You have to be there. The show must go on, and it's the same with art. Now, being 100% reliable, efficient, and organized, there's a theory, isn't there, that the artistic side of the brain does not correlate with that 100% being reliable, turning up on time. They don't mix very well. They're like oil and water. Now, that depends on what kind of person you are, what kind of character you are, how you were brought up, everything about you. You may be known for being completely unreliable in everything you do, in which case, just because you've chosen to do art doesn't mean you're going to suddenly start being reliable. You have to organize yourself, but of course, everyone's different. Everyone's different, and everyone has to make their own way in life. I know that for myself, I could not operate with all the things I've got going on if I didn't compartmentalize them and organize them in a way that enables me to cope and deliver what I have to deliver, whether it's painting time, interview time, teaching time, workshops, getting ready for a show. Plus, of course, I've got a normal life to lead as well. So I've got to take the dog for a walk and other stuff. So you need to fit all these things in around your time. And we want to pass our time on Earth in the most enjoyable way we can. And part of the enjoyment comes from being organized, so you're delivering the right amount of content to the right component. And that's how I try to organize myself.
I think that's such great advice for people to hear. And I really think, because I've known Peter a long time now, I think Peter and I can both speak to this, that as you've said, organization and reliability for both of Peter and I, and yourself, obviously, David, are key components of running a business. And I come from a background of being naturally extremely disorganized and struggling with all this. My point, and there is a point to this, but my point being that for some it comes more naturally, yes, but this is a learnable skill. Just like you can learn techniques and approaches to painting and then develop that in a way that suits you as an individual, I'm proof that you can learn to be organized and you can learn to run a business, but it is important that you do so. And you may even look to other people to help teach you or share with you how they are organized, and maybe some of that will work for you. So everything you said there, David, I think was absolutely spot on and really important for people to hear, definitely.
Well, it's very nice that you all agree with me. We're on the same path.
I think also a really important point, Dave, and again, I'm sure Peter can speak to this, is that you, as you said, you might not think that being creative and being an artist goes hand in hand with being organized, and there's a certain romance to being a disheveled, disorganized artist who just throws paint around, all of this stuff. But actually, the more organized I've become, the more easy it's been to balance my life with painting, and actually the more time I am able to devote with the right frame of mind to my creative practice, and therefore I can be creative and flamboyant and arty, but within these very organized little spaces and boxes of time, which again is a skill that I've had to develop and a certain discipline which I've had to learn, but it's absolutely vital in my business and my life. And I'm sure, Peter, you can speak to the same.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when you ring fence, is the phrase I use, ring fence time in which to be creative, and then this an area is where I'm going to plan, and this area is where I'm going to do administration and marketing and all that sort of stuff, not only will it protect those very individual activities, but then it allows me to focus very deeply into each activity, and then as a result get decent amount of progress and growth within marketing or within being organized and so on. If one is to work in a very muddled way where everything is overlapping, of course you cannot give it the correct focused amount of time, and then you're not getting any development and it's easy to get lost and confused and so on. So I agree, it's the perception that being organized and being creative don't go hand in hand, but I agree that when one does give it that initial time and understand where the parameters are and ring fence it, it actually allows you to become more creative in very kind of safe spaces and safe periods of time.
That's exactly true, Peter and Tom. You understand completely what we're talking about. But we know, and the artists listening will know, once you start your actual painting session, or drawing session, a different part of your head kicks in. And intuition takes over, and that's where you drift off into this amazing place where time stands still, and you are to a certain extent disorganized because you miss the call for dinner or something else, or that can wait. Now that feeling, that painting time, that zone you're in, is as important, in fact probably more important, than all your time organizing yourself. Mm. They are separate things, and of course we do need to a certain amount of organization when we're painting to know we're reaching for that color, we're not going to wreck our painting by doing something ridiculous. But that is where the thousands of hours that you spend developing your practice come in, because it's intuitive. I don't set out to mix a certain colour. I find that colour intuitively by layering or mixing. I don't think, how do I mix a colour? How do I mix that colour? It never occurs to me. Somehow, I end up with the right colour for that moment. And that moment depends on how we feel at that moment. It's the right colour for the moment. And you need to go with that flow and just enjoy it while you can.
It reinforces that famous phrase, is all painting is feeling, isn't it? That feeling has to come first. And you said that very early on in the interview. Your inspiration, whatever you're looking for, it needs to excite you. It needs to spark that curiosity and interest. Because without that, I think art becomes just very functional. You're just doing something without any kind of real meaning, depth or purpose to what you are as an artist.
If there's no enjoyment or enthusiasm or inspiration, it's a pointless pursuit. Mm. You may as well be doing the garden or something else. Mm. Not that gardening is a good thing to do as well, so don't get the wrong idea. Listeners, gardening is a very good thing to do, as is growing vegetables.
Absolutely. We get asked a lot of questions, David, about sort of the marketing and promoting yourself as an artist. And there are some artists that do this in different ways. Some work very exclusively with galleries. Other artists completely go it alone. Some artists do a mixture and a myriad of things. So from your perspective, from a marketing perspective, sharing your work with the world, telling the world what you do, and thus encouraging customers to invest in us, can you share a little bit about how you approach marketing and what you have discovered works well specifically for you and your practice?
So it all starts off with what you paint and how you feel about it and being completely honest about it to the point where you can talk about it without it being fake or false.
Yeah.
You need to be honest with yourself and think, I've got something, you've got something worth saying, and what you say reflects what you put on the paper or the canvas. So, in terms of practicalities, it's true, isn't it, that in the age in which we live, the high street gallery, a lot of them cease to exist. Why? It's the age we live in. And also, I think it's true to say that a lot of people that ran galleries weren't in tune with the realities of running a business. So they have their little favourites, their clique, their cosy club artists, this and that, and they're not in tune with what ordinary people, what they would like, what touches them, what they want to have in their house to live with. Because when someone buys a painting, they're not just buying something they put on the wall, they're buying a piece of you as an artist and what you stand for, and they're putting that on the wall.
So you're saying there's an awareness of the customer, you know, you have an awareness of your customer.
You need to find your own marketplace. Now, how can you find that? Okay, some practical suggestions. Every town, village and city has in it art clubs, art societies, groups of people that have got over their nervousness and want to meet other people that do similar things. So my advice, join a little art group if you would like to. You could even start your own with a couple of friends. It's important to just mix with other people that do the same thing that you do. Now, of course, we have, don't we, social media. If they're approached the right way, they are useful, especially to us as artists or anybody creative. It's free as well, even better. So you can put your painting on your Facebook page. Don't say, what do you think about this, guys? Don't invite nice comments, okay? Don't invite any comments. That's probably a good, better way of putting it. Because you'll always get people who will argue with you, and you don't want to do that. Another piece of advice, never argue with anybody on social media. If in doubt, leave it out. That's the best rule I can say. If in doubt, leave it out. Just put your painting up, say what you've called it, what you've painted it with, and just leave it and see what happens. Now, it's true. You get people liking it. There's always a thumbs up button, but there's not a thumbs down, thankfully, because you'd probably get a lot of thumbs down, and then that would put you off painting. So that's the start. You get people that like what you do. Some people will just scroll on by and not like it. Some people will put nice comments. From there, you can form the basis of people that follow what you do. Important to be consistent with what you do. Consistent of the quality of the work that you produce, in that it's of a certain level, represents where you are now. In 10 years' time, you might look back at what you've done now and think, God, that is terrible. You know, but at the time, you quite liked it. And so did a lot of other people. You know, because we're all developing as we go on. Build up a following. Look at other people's pages. Follow other artists. And comment on what they do. It's only by interaction with other people that you will persuade people, in the lightest possible use of the word persuade, to join in with what you do. If you are just one of these people that just wants other people to like them and not interact with other people, then not a lot will happen. You will still be alone at the end of the day.
So it's about being an active member within the community, isn't it? You have to sort of be as part of it and not just expect it on yourself.
Exactly. And if you progress, you get lots of people liking what you do. You're building up a bit of a following, a bit of a fan base, which is very nice. But still do the interaction with other people. Don't become an egomaniac and take it for granted. Never take any of this for granted. Everyone that likes what you do or comments on what you do in a nice way, they are all very precious people. And you must appreciate them. Totally. And try to give them back what they're giving you. They're giving you encouragement. Reciprocate. Give them encouragement back. Wherever they are on their own journey, it's sharing and caring is very important.
Instead of that social media, which works to a point and it lives in the digital realm, how important is it for you as an artist and running your career as an artist, as a business, how important is it that interactivity with people in a live event and in a live experience in a one-to-one capacity?
As we all know, painting usually is a very solitary activity. And in some ways, that's what's great about it, because you can just do it on your own. However, it can be a very strange place, and it's very strange, and it's important to interact with people in real life. When you actually go to an event, it's real. You're forced to get out, dress up, go to a show, and be, hopefully, still yourself or a version of yourself. Now, meeting people, relationships are formed. Some are ended. You can see what people are doing in real life. That photo that you saw on Facebook of that particular painting, when you see it in real life, could look something completely different. Because remember, when you're looking at things on Facebook or Instagram, you're looking at something the size of a stamp. When you see it in real life, you can see all the little marks, the flaws, the good things, the bad things, and it might look completely different. Also remember that what you look at on your computer has a glow, the light from the computer, which makes it look better. In real life, there's no hiding place. If the painting works, it moves the viewer, as I said, transcends that mere visual experience and touches them. In reality, you're just trying to touch one person with your painting enough for them to want to live with that work and to buy it. Because as professional artists, we do need to earn a living.
The kind of takeaway points I've got from you, one is definitely persistence in all areas of what you're doing. And you've spoken also about consistency. And then I think also balancing, you're forever balancing worlds, like, you know, balancing admin versus creativity, balancing online world versus, you know, in person. And I think a sort of an underlying theme that I've really enjoyed is finding this way of kind of satisfying yourself for all of this as well. Like, it's got to be something that you enjoy, and your creative pursuit, but also your life as well, which your business is tied up in that. So that for me has been what I've really enjoyed and taken from the way that you've spoken about your career and your creativity. I wonder if you could kind of leave us, you've given us so many little gems anyway, but could you leave us just with like a little cheeky final thought, a little bit of advice, a little bit of inspiration, whether it's regarding creativity or just life in general, like a little nugget to go away with?
So many nuggets I could pick up, Tom. But I think, actually, and I've used this nugget before, and I use it with my students when I'm running a workshop, is that watercolour painting is not a race. It's a search for yourself.
Perfect. We can leave it right there. David, where can people find out more about you? Talking about online, you know, websites, social media, if they want to connect with you, see what you're up to.
So I have my own website, which is davidpoxon.co.uk. And on that website, you can find out a little bit more about me. You can see a gallery of some of my paintings. There's also my book, which is called Watercolour Heart and Soul, which you can order direct from my website. You can also order prints, a selection of prints, and find out a bit more about me and also where I may be appearing. So that's one place you can find out about me. Also on Facebook and Instagram, just put my name in and hopefully it will be the real David Poxon that pops up. You can also find out more about me at my show that I'm organising, which is called International Watercolour Masters, which is a biennial show. It's all taking place at Lillishall Hall, Shropshire, England, in May 2024. And the website for that, to find out everything about it, iwm2024.com.
That's great. Thank you. And what we'll do, everybody, is we're going to make sure that all the links that David has just shared, we'll make sure they are on the Ask an Artist podcast website and our social media as well. So you can click on those and find them there. Thank you, David. Thank you so much for joining us. And for those of you that would like to find out a little bit more information about this International Watercolour Masters, well, stay tuned, because we will be inviting David back to talk a little bit more about that. But thank you, everyone, for listening. And thank you so much for all your reviews and your ratings, both on our website and on Apple Podcasts. They really do help keep the podcast visible and free for everybody. We'll see you again next time.
I have been using Jackson's Art Supplies for as long as I can remember, and with good reason. They have absolutely everything you could ever think of and want. They even have all of those extra little bits and bobs that you would need to kit out your studio to the full. They also have a bespoke canvas and framing service, and something that makes them really stand out is their fantastic blog, packed full of information on not only materials, but lots of insight into other working artists. To check out all that's on offer, please visit jacksonsart.com.